blood, feeding from live subjects. He hushed me when I opened my mouth to protest. I know how you feel about feeding from humans, but I want you to have the skills you need to survive. Just in case. I want you to be able to hunt on your own.
So I'm like a domesticated bear and you're working up to releasing me into the wild?
Yes. That's the worst possible way you could have taken this gesture, thank you. He muttered, setting the cooler aside.
Thank you, I finally said. I appreciate the fact that you thought of me while you were away.
Every spare moment, he promised, moving in closer for a kiss.
I stopped him. Are you sure I'm not accused of something? Feeding on senior citizens? Kicking toddlers? Stealing candy from babies? He was darkly cute when he was indignant.
It's not a bad omen every time I come to call.
You're right, I conceded. I'm being rude. To what do I owe the pleasure? In a very serious tone, he said,
I think we should have sex again.
What? I giggled. I couldn't help it. Gabriel and I hadn't been able to date, per se. Dating a vampire is difficult even if you are a vampire. I mean, it's not as if we can go out to dinner like a normal couple. We don't eat. On the rare occasion that we were both at one of our houses and sitting still, Zeb and Jolene or Andrea or Dick would show up, and our twosome became a group gathering. As much as I loved having a close group of diverse friends who understand my special needs, talk about a bunch of mood killers.
I think we should have sex again, he repeated. I think we've reestablished our rapport and friendship. I believe you're starting to trust me again. I know you want me.
That's kind of presumptuous, I told him. He wasn't wrong, but it was still presumptuous. Obviously irritated by my not jumping him right then and there, he added.
Also, the first time was rather rushed, and I don't feel that I was able to demonstrate my full range of, technique.
So you think we should have naked, happy fun time because I didn't get to see all of your moves? I said, barely able to contain a second giggle fit as he backed me against the counter. You don't just say something like that. You have to take me out for dinner or something.
Here.
He reached into the fridge and pulled out a packet of A-negative.
Drink that.
I arched an eyebrow at him. You really don't understand the concept of modern courtship, do you?
Drink it, he commanded.
Humoring him, I popped the top and took a long drink of the smooth, lusciously nutty donated blood. Tasting genuine human blood after months of synthetic always left me a little woozy. Little pinpricks of sensation, nerves firing along my arms and throat, made me lean heavily against the counter to get my bearings. Gabriel took the packet from my slightly trembling hand.
Now, kiss me.
I'm not a light bulb. You can't just flip a switch and turn me. Gabriel gripped my cheeks between his palms and seized my lips, the last syllables of my sentence muffled into his mouth.
I stand corrected, I admitted as we backed into the living room. Is your aunt here?
He asked, tugging at my t-shirt. I shook my head. Hot ghost date.
I think... Gah!
Distracted by the front closure on my bra, Gabriel had tripped over a footstool and knocked over a side table. It might be nice to have sex without breaking anything. What do you say? I asked, peeking down at him over the edge of the table. Gabriel sat up, rubbing his forehead where my old hard-bound copy of Sense and Sensibility had conked him.
Haven't you already read this a few dozen times?
He asked, flipping through the pages.
We're going to have a literary intervention for you.
It's Jane Austen, so I'm going to pretend I didn't hear you say that, I said, settling next to him and taking the book from his hands. You can never read Jane Austen too many times, and this is one of my favorites. She manages to pull a believable happy ending out of what could have been her saddest story. She could have left the Dashwood sisters alone, having learned their lesson from their respective traits. Marianne could have been left alone and ruined by her dramatic, impetuous behavior. Eleanor could have taken her quiet dignity to a maiden's grave. But she gave them the men they wanted, or, in Marianne's case, needed. Austen let both of them have a little bit more than they deserved.
I love it when you talk about books, he murmured against my neck. It gets you all excited. Quick, tell me your theories about Jane Eyre and sexual repression again.
My burst of laughter was silenced by the press of Gabriel's mouth. It's amazing how much easier it is to be naked in front of another person when you have a little self-confidence. In order to attract prey, vampires are usually more attractive than they were in life. So I got the high school bookworm's golden ticket. My skin was clearer. My hair had changed to an actually desirable color found in the brunette spectrum and did what it was supposed to on occasion. My eyes, formerly an unremarkable muddy hazel, were now a clear and compelling hazel. My teeth were whiter, and my chest was in the locked and upright position forevermore. I never had to worry about sagging. If Mama would admit to my being a vampire, even she would have to concede that it seemed to agree with me. Mama probably wouldn't have mentioned the boob thing specifically, though. Emboldened by my newfound confidence, I jumped over the couch and pounced on Gabriel, gleefully ripping at the buttons of his shirt. He was too busy slowly peeling off my socks to object. He grinned madly at my feet. "What?" I asked, hoping that after all of this I hadn't accidentally fallen for a foot fetishist. "I just never know what color your toenails are going to be," he said, stroking my instep and kissing my ankle. "Will it be a prim pink, a contemplative cranberry, a playful plum?" "My toes are like a mood ring. Good to know. Now I believe you were kissing my ankle in a very pleasant manner. Feel free to continue," I commanded, wiggling my freshly painted carpals. "What is that?" he asked, staring with horror at the virulent shade of pulpy peach on my toenails. I had to mix three different shades to find a peach that would match Jolene's bridesmaids' dresses. I did an experimental test run to see if my body would tolerate the color. "Wow," Gabriel mouthed silently. "Shut it," I said, tossing the remnants of his shirt into a wastebasket. He took advantage of this lapse of concentration to pull me onto his lap, wrapping my legs around his waist. I smirked down at him, tucking his hair behind his ears. "How about we try to make it to a bed this time?" Gabriel didn't answer, as his mouth was occupied, scraping his fangs gently over the curve of my breast. I loved and hated it when he did that. Loved it because he was teasing me, toying with me, reminding me of every dark pleasure he could inflict on me. Hated it because it reduced my whole world to a square inch of responsive flesh, making me forget everything. Pride, sense, the ability to refrain from bizarre bird call noises. My only defense was winding my fingers through his ink-black hair, pulling his head back and sucking on his bottom lip. He groaned into my mouth.
"Unfair."
"All's fair and oomph," I grunted as he smothered my mouth with his and pushed me to my feet.
"You're wearing too much."
His low voice vibrated across the skin of my throat. He refused to pull his lips away from my skin as he split my old 4-H camp t-shirt down the front and tossed it into the trash with his own shirt. I glared at him. He shrugged, pulling the bandana from my head and shaking my hair loose.
"All's fair."
We were both grinning loopily as we stripped each other, tossing clothes carelessly across the room. Gabriel continued to put my sensitive nerves to good use as he stroked the line of my back with his long fingers. I never stopped kissing him, deep, sweet, hot kisses that left me confused about where his lips started and mine ended. One of the drawbacks of living in a Civil War home is knowing that no matter what you do there, it's already been done before. You're never the first. Well, I'm pretty sure I'm the first early to do any of those things on the Grand Staircase once featured in the Half Moon Hollow Historical Society's spring tour of homes. On an unrelated note, I was really glad I'd taken those yoga classes with Andrea. Without them, I might not have had the strength and flexibility required to balance on the stairs with my arms while Gabriel raised my hips and sank deep inside me. I threw my head back, sighing, contented. How could I have forgotten how good that was? How complete and full he made me feel. I hardly noticed that with each thrust I landed one step closer to the top of the stairs. I arched my back, grinding down until he nudged against the sensitive little bundle of nerves. I wrapped my arms around his neck on impulse, landing hard on my back without their support. The force knocked both of us down two steps, the impact of each bump sending shock waves through my body. Gabriel groaned, the hum of his voice against my collarbone sending me over the edge. I clenched around him, crying out as red starbursts exploded behind my eyelids. Seeing my face as I climaxed had some strange effect on Gabriel. Moaning softly in my ear, he begged me to open my eyes. I obeyed and found him watching me, memorizing every detail of my face. I turned my face into his cradling palm and bit down on the tender skin between his thumb and forefinger with my blunter teeth. He yowled, surprised, and grinned obscenely just before he shuddered over me. We slid down the stairs one at a time as he came. We slithered to a stop on the third step. I sighed.
I missed you.
That's what a man likes to hear,
he said, pulling me onto his chest and nuzzling the curve of my throat. I blew out an unnecessary breath.
This is just like our first time, without all the hitting and bleeding. I know we haven't addressed this, but I totally won that fight.
I admire your competitive nature and optimism, but there's no way you would have beaten me in a fair fight.
I smirked. Would it make you feel better if I went all traditional and asked you what you were thinking in some soft, hesitant voice? Because right now, all I'm thinking is, woo! And if I might add, whoo!
It saddens me that I don't know whether this is the stunning after-effects of my technique or that you're spending more time with Dick.
So, what are you thinking? He asked in that faux feminine voice again, pressing little kisses along my wrist.
Because I very much doubt that woo and who is all that's going on in that massive, teeming brain of yours.
I propped my chin on his chest. Do you really want to know? Because at any given moment when I'm with you, I have about a million questions bouncing around in my head, stuff that, frankly, I'm a little ashamed I don't know about you. For instance, why don't you have an accent? You and Dick grew up together. He has a respectable drawl. But you sound as if you're from the middle of nowhere, only with a slightly stuck-up British vernacular. He pushed my hair back from my face.
Well, you know what they say. When in Rome.
Attempt to sound nothing like the Romans? I countered.
No, I was actually in Rome, and I was saying y'all, he said. It was hard to blend into the crowd. While I was traveling, I did my best to get rid of my accent and the use of y'all. Happy now?
No. There's still stuff that I don't know about you, like, what was your dog's name when you were a kid? What was the first book you can remember reading? What was your favorite food before you returned? Did you like pancakes? What's your favorite movie made after 1970? Don't say Scarface. Please don't say Scarface.
Bridges of Madison County.
What?
Fine, that was a lie. I enjoyed Edward Scissorhands.
Really? A loner with a dangerous condition that keeps him at arm's length from most people, I teased.
Don't see that at all. Would it have made you happier if I said Rocky?
He groused.
What's your favorite movie, O Protector of Cinematic Integrity?
Whatever is readily available that has Gerard Butler in it, I told him. Except for P.S. I Love You. Even I have standards. Well, the incompatible movie choices cinch it. Gabriel's a couple. I say we're doomed. I shook my head, sadly.
I hope that's not true, he said, grinning. I have long-term plans for you.
Really? I asked, and immediately cringed at the astonishment in my voice.
Of course I do, he said, his eyes narrowed. Don't you think of me when you imagine where you'll be in the next century or so? Don't I factor into your plans?
I ducked my head and concentrated on the patterns in the rug. Yeah, but it's different. I've never been a vampire without you, but you've been at this for so long. You know how vampire relationships play out. I don't. And you know how to get along without me. Sometimes I wonder...
Wonder what?
I wonder when you're going to get tired of me, I said. I mean, this can't last forever, right? For me, nothing this good lasts forever. And we don't have any sort of... We haven't really talked about the long term... I'm going to stop talking now. Gabriel opened his mouth to protest, then snapped it shut. After a few moments' consideration, he blurted out,
Is this because I haven't said that I love you?
No, I said, caught off guard enough to gape at him a little. Are vampires even capable of love?
Jane, that hurts me, he said.
It shouldn't. I honestly have no idea. I love my parents, I love Zeb, I love Aunt Jetty, but I had those emotions before I was turned. How do I know they aren't just residual echoes of what I felt when I was human? I was never in love with a man as a human. I'm not sure I would recognize the feeling. I really like you. Does that help?
He made a face.
Have you ever been close to getting married? I asked. Do you want to get married? He grinned down at me.
Is that a proposal?
I ignored him. Are we even able to get married, legally?
No, not yet, he said. If a vampire was married before being turned, and the spouse is still human, the marriage is still legal and valid. It took the council nearly 2 years of lobbying Congress to accomplish that. We're still working on establishing after-death rights for vampires. We are technically dead, so hardline conservatives insist that we don't have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Marriage, adoption, voting. I gasped. We can't vote? You didn't notice that in November, during the election?
Of course I did, because I vote. I protested. Okay, fine, I didn't even try to vote. I forgot. I'm a horrible person.
He shrugged, patting my head. Well, you had to have flaws. You don't vote or have tact or have control over most of your gross motor functions.
Okay, stop that, I said, pinching his arm. And stop trying to get out of talking about your marriage feelings. Have you ever been close to getting married?
Yes, he said, rubbing his eyes. Her name was Mary Louise Early. Her parents were dear friends of my parents. My father wanted access to their pasture land. It was a good match.
Wait, so you were engaged to one of my ancestors?
I scooched away from him.
Ew.
This is why I don't tell you about my past. I'm not enigmatic and secretive. I'm trying to keep you from doing... Ow!
He cried as I pinched him again.
That. We were not officially engaged at the time of my death. We were promised, that's all.
Did you sleep with her? Because that would just be weird. He seemed insulted that I was calling his before-death self a horn dog.
Of course not. We were never left unchaperoned. She was wearing 12 layers of underwear at all times, and she had a laugh that made my ears bleed.
Humph, I snorted. Awkward silence. So, how was Nashville? I asked.
The new manager is an idiot,
Gabriel said of the radio station employee he'd traveled to Tennessee to meet. Translation, yell at in a scary vampire voice.
He's a fan of Jethro Tull and wants to change the format to soft rock. I'm either going to fire him or make him believe he's a 9-year-old Girl Scout.
He stroked my hair back from my face.
How's the wedding planning going?
I don't want to talk about it, I groaned.
The dress is that bad?
He asked. He was trying to look sympathetic, but vampire fangs tend to give away hidden smiles.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, at least you don't have to go to the bachelor party. Zeb said Dick has made arrangements for us to visit the booby hatch on amateur night.
Gabriel grimaced at using the word booby. You're telling your girlfriend that you're going to a strip club, I said, narrowing my eyes at him.
Yes.
Do you know what happens at strip clubs? I asked. He laughed.
I'm sure it will be fine. We'll have a few drinks, get him something to eat, and get him home.
You honestly don't understand how strip clubs work, do you?
Gabriel snorted. So how is Zeb's wedding driving you into the abyss of madness?
It's the whole thing, I grumbled. It's not that I don't like Jolene. In fact, I'm pretty sure I like her much more than I would have liked anyone else who married Zeb. With the exception of her constantly eating in front of me, I like everything about her. She's nice and funny and obviously loves my friend. It's just that...
She drives you crazy?
He offered. A tiny bit. I sighed.
I think that you've gotten used to being the female influence in Zeb's life,
Gabriel said, squeezing me.
There's nothing wrong with it. I think the friendship between you two is a beautiful thing. But he understood when you began spending time with me, and he's made it easy for me to become a part of your life. I would be very disappointed in you if you weren't able to do the same for him.
Fine. I will take the mature route even if you have to check me into some sort of vampire mental institution immediately after the reception.
Jane, he said, winding his arms and legs around me.
Letting it go, I nodded, playing with the curling ends of his hair. Now that I have your attention, I think we should test that vampire endurance I hear so much about.
To think you were this innocent little librarian when I met you.
Gabriel heaved a mock sigh.
I've created a monster.
I grinned, my fangs extending over my lips. In more ways than one. Well, I finally got my revenge for all those times I'd walked in on Fred and Jetty. She came home to find me sprawled on the couch, wearing nothing but Gabriel's shirt, sitting in a very naked man's lap. I'd always been disappointed that River Oaks doesn't have a great ghost story attached to it. Of course, now it does. Aunt Jetty. Jetty was my own personal daytime security system. She woke me up when someone, such as grabby family antique enthusiasts Grandma Ruthie and Jenny, tried to get into the house. She also chased away door-to-door salesmen, meter readers, and evangelists with vague unease and spooky noises. Unless you have some sort of psychic ability, ghosts decide when they want you to see them. Which is good, because I don't think I'd want to walk around seeing dead people on every corner. Just when Jetty had decided to let Gabriel see her, she was seeing a whole lot of him. Ever poised, he wrapped an afghan around his waist and held a perfectly civil conversation with her. The utter mortification forced me to block most of it from memory. I know she brought up the phrase steam cleaning a lot. Gabriel promised a call and made himself scarce. There was practically a Gabriel-shaped hole in the door. Where have you been? I asked her, hands on bare hips. I haven't seen you for 4 days, and then you just waltz in without so much as a how do you do? Am I going to have to ground you to get you to spend time with me? It's that boy you've been seeing, isn't it?
I don't want to talk about it, Jetty huffed. Your Grandpa Fred is becoming an ass in his post-old age. We spent the last 3 days fighting. Do you know how difficult it is to win a conversation with a man who no longer fears death?
I nodded. As a matter of fact, yes, I do.
If we're going to talk about boys, can we discuss the fact that Gabriel only wears pants on every other visit here?
Jetty asked. No. Instead, I will change the subject and announce to you that there is a new potential addition to Half Moon Hollow's ghostly population. Grandpa Bob died on Tuesday. Grandma Ruthie said there was some sort of medication mix-up.
The hell there was, Jetty cackled. Fred says it's all over the golf course. Bob Jessup died because he couldn't quite make out the dosage on his little blue tablets, and he took too many. Apparently it was their anniversary, and Bob wanted to rise to the occasion.
Oh. Oh, just, oh. I shuddered, clapping my hand over my lips. I think I just threw up a little in my mouth. Is Bob still wandering around out there?
Oh, no. He's moved on. He just made a quick stop at his son's house to say goodbye. He happened to run into Sago Rains, who's been haunting the place for years. They talked a bit before he went into the light. Sago was down at the golf course spreading the news faster than you can say erectile dysfunction.
La 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 la, I sang, pressing my hands over my ears, but even that couldn't keep me from hearing her.
I just wish I could get to Ruthie long enough to tell her every dead soul in the Hollow knows her dearly departed had to have pharmaceutical help to—
Enough, I cried. First you and Grandpa Fred, and now just enough. I'd pierce my own eardrums, but they would just grow back.
Ageist,
Jetty sneered. Exhibitionist, I retorted.
I don't think you can afford to throw any naked stones here, pumpkin.
I nodded. Touché. Chapter 4. Because of the lifelong mating urge, werewolves do not adjust well to being widowed. In some cases, a surviving mate will die of mourning pains. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. Perhaps sensing that Bob's could be her last grand damn funeral, Grandma Ruthie wanted to bury Bob in style. NATO summits were less tense than the planning of this shindig. Bob's adult children claimed that Bob, an avid fisherman, wanted to be cremated, with half of his ashes spread into Lake Barkley and the other half interred with his late first wife. Grandma Ruthie, incensed that she might be upstaged, insisted that Bob's intact remains be buried adjacent to her compound of husbandly burial plots down at Oakview Cemetery. She made such a scene at the funeral home that Bob's shell-shocked offspring let her have her way, plus total control of the funeral program, from the Amazing Grace opener to the It Is Well With My Soul Old Rugged Cross closing medley. There was only one place to host this weird-ass parody of grief, Whitlow's funeral home, where Grandma Ruthie had been mourning husbands since 1957. In fact, three generations of Whitlows had helped Grandma Ruthie bury her spouses, and apparently none of them knew anything about decorating. Honestly, who finds dark wood paneling, blue velvet upholstery, and 3D pictures of Jesus comforting? With her frequent flyer status, Grandma Ruthie was treated like a queen from the moment she walked in the door. She never settled for the rattling Coke machine and sprung couch in the sadly worn family lounge. When the stress of public mourning became too much to bear, Grandma Ruthie retreated to the senior Mr. Whitlow's private office, where he stocked her favorite brand of butter cookies and an ample supply of bottled sweet tea. Membership has its privileges. Visitations were held on the evening before the burial, giving the community the chance to offer condolences to the bereaved and give their real opinion of the deceased outside the bereaved's earshot. Grandma Ruthie was ensconced in the front row of the chapel, sending petulant looks at Bob's children. She was still pouting over their last-minute refusal to let her take over the memorial video or the photo board. Somehow, they seemed insulted that Grandma wanted to focus on the last 5 years of Bob's life, omitting his first marriage to their late mother and the existence of his children and grandchildren. She did get her vengeance by making a memorial Wheel of Fortune puzzle board spelling out, "Ruthie loves Bob," and putting it on the lid of his casket. Bob was a huge Wheel fan. Based on the craftsmanship, I suspected my sister Jenny had a hand in this. Grandma Ruthie simply did not understand why she was not being given the authority and respect due a widow. She claimed to have given Bob some of the happiest years of his life. The fact that Bob had been unconscious or hospitalized for most of that time seemed irrelevant. Grandma Ruthie, and Jenny, for that matter, were a little miffed at Mama for her resolve that I be involved in the funeral. I would have been touched by Mama's insistence on my having the opportunity to mourn Bob, but I'm pretty sure she just wanted help policing the buffet at the visitation. I didn't eat, after all, so I wouldn't mind keeping the platters full. The main problem was that Grandma insisted on using her good silver serving pieces from wedding number two, which were mixed in with the stainless steel pieces from the funeral home. You'd think by now I'd be able to sniff out metal that causes me to burn and itch, but every time I moved a utensil, it was like Russian roulette. So I stuck with plates. It is an unwritten law that a person could not be decently buried in the hollow without the presence of deviled eggs and some form of homemade pimento cheese. My cousin Junie's hot dog bake is also usually present. It's essentially diced hot dogs, tater tots, processed cheese food, and cream of mushroom soup baked until crusty. Still, it's preferable to homemade pimento cheese. Of course, for humans, nourishment is needed to sustain them through the gauntlet of social interactions. If you met anyone in the deceased's family once, you are expected to bring a casserole for the bereaved and spend at least 25 minutes at the visitation. This meant that if I wanted to cross the room, I was going to have to talk to every person I had ever met in my entire life. And I had no idea how many of them might be packing steaks. Not everybody in Half Moon Hollow knew I'd been turned, but many of those who did looked at me with a combination of fear and revulsion. I'll admit that I spent much of my living time being annoyed at my human community, but being separated from them now was lonely and isolating. The only place I felt safe was at River Oaks, and then a group of high school kids wrapped my entire porch in hanks of dried garlic. It was an incredibly lame and yet surprisingly effective way to make me afraid in my own home. For this reason, and so many more, I specifically asked Gabriel not to attend the funeral. I did not feel this was the appropriate occasion to introduce him to my family. When he asked which occasion would be appropriate, I stayed stonily silent. I think it hurt his feelings. I could see now that I might have been better off with my sire nearby. After a few training sessions spent trying to hone my mind-reading talents, Gabriel and I determined that it only worked on humans. Most humans. Some humans. Sometimes. It was pretty inconsistent. Still, after finding out how many people secretly disliked me inside their heads, not being able to see inside my fellow vampires was kind of a comfort. According to the swarms of thoughts and scents pecking at my cortex, some of those attending the funeral knew I was a vampire, but they were nice enough not to mention it. Or, at least, to mention it quietly behind their hands in a way that was not noticed by the other mourners. Such is the delicate social web of a small southern town. I knew that they knew. My family knew that some of them knew. They knew I knew that they knew. But none of us said anything, because that would cause unpleasantness. And we are nothing if not pleasant when other people are watching. Zeb and Jolene were lurking among the crowd, earning attendance points for Zeb and his family, but avoiding actual contact with anybody. Lucky bastard. Jolene did, however, bring a huge sandwich platter and a gallon of macaroni salad from her uncle's shop, The Three Little Pigs. I was 99% sure that meant Grandma Ruthie now liked her better than me. Mama Ginger was hovering over the mini quiches and glowering in Jolene's general direction. Fortunately, Mama Ginger had been too ill since Zeb's announcement to contribute anything to the funeral buffet. Everything she made tasted like blue cheese and glue. You'd think she'd be thrilled that her son was marrying a good girl with a local family who wouldn't ask her son to move far from hearth and home. Plus, with her flashing lupine eyes and auburn hair, Jolene was beautiful in that fierce, some-people-walk-in-the-light way that just seems unfair to those of us whose genes aligned in a less spectacular fashion. Instead, Zeb said that upon hearing his engagement announcement, Mama Ginger accused him of letting little Zeb do all of his thinking for him. Floyd had nodded in agreement, but it was in more of an envious, congratulatory way. Much like the iceberg that doomed the unsinkable ship, the visible workings of the Lavelle-McLean wedding plans were only the tiniest glimpse of passive-aggressive maneuverings below the surface. Being truly disliked for the first time in her life sent Jolene into some sort of prolonged panic state where she did almost anything to try to get Mama Ginger to like her. This, of course, just irritated the hell out of Mama Ginger. She would not bond with Jolene. She simply refused to. Just as she'd refused to shop for Mother of the Bride dresses with the clingy bride. She would not meet Jolene for lunch to discuss floral arrangements or seating charts. She faked a gluten allergy to get out of tasting the wedding cake. I hadn't seen Mama Ginger since I'd started keeping night hours. Henna-haired and built like a neurotic fire hydrant, Zeb's mother was wearing her burying dress of clingy black lycra, bedazzled with intricate patterns of tiny gold-toned studs and rhinestones. There was a matching hat, but Mama Ginger wouldn't dare cover her colored, curled, and coiled coiffure, which as a hairdresser she considered her own best advertisement. Mama Ginger, who never left the house without full pancake makeup and eyeliner, usually ambushed me with one of the 15 nubbed lipsticks she kept in the bottom of her purse to give me a little color. Eager to avoid a scene in which I would be left with a linty coat of risque red, I backed away. The movement caught Mama Ginger's attention, and before I knew it, I'd made inadvertent eye contact. "Bah! Jane," Mama Ginger squealed. "Oh, honey, come on over here and give me some sugar." Across the room, Zeb's eyes widened as Mama Ginger enveloped me in a hug that would usually have left me smelling of Jean Nate and Virginia Slims. Except this time, the scent of lady-grade tobacco was dramatically understated. Zeb shot me an apologetic look and then turned his back and busied himself with some punch. "Coward."
"You're so skinny. You need to get over there and eat something. I worry about you. Poor single girl always on some crazy diet. You need someone to cook for, honey. That will put some meat on your bones."
Mama Ginger mercilessly squeezed my cheeks with her carefully painted acrylic nails.
Now, how are you, baby girl? Tell me every little thing.
I'm fine. Mama Ginger, did you quit smoking? I asked, sniffing her again.
Yes, I did,
she cried.
How did you know?
Don't say smell. Don't say smell. I spotted a pack of nicotine gum in her purse and nodded to it. Mama Ginger giggled.
You'll never believe this, but I went to that Madame Zelda over on Gaines Street.
The mesmerist tarot reader who offers palm readings for $5 from her den?
That's the one. She does a special course of smoke-free sessions. It's 5 hypnosis sessions for $250. Pricey, but it's done the trick.
Mama Ginger had left at least 2 packs of Revlon-stained cigarette butts in her wake every day since I'd known her. In fact, she once lit up in the middle of her annual physical, right after her doctor told her that she was at risk for 7 kinds of cancer. People take bad news in different ways. I could only guess that the faint cigarette smell still lingering on Mama Ginger was nicotine that had seeped into her DNA.
I'm chewing this silly gum.
She sighed, rolling up her sleeve to show me a nicotine patch on her arm.
And I only smoke after meals, but really, I'm feeling much better. I can walk all the way to the mailbox without a break.
I would be concerned, but honestly, the combination of occasional smoking, chewing, and, patching probably equaled the amount of nicotine in Mama Ginger's system when she was smoking full-time.
I never thought I'd quit. Never wanted to.
Mama Ginger said, ignoring common sense in her usual selective fashion.
But Mama Lavelle's doctor put her on an oxygen tank, and she screams that I'm trying to kill her if I light up anywhere near her. Hell, if I was going to kill the woman, I would have switched her heart pills for baby aspirin 10 years ago.
I goggled at her. She blushed and gave a tinkling laugh.
Zeb says you have a new job. How do you like it?
Fine. Not that I'm not glad to see you, Mama Ginger, but I thought you were mad at me. I looked in the direction of Hannah Jo, her favorite client and preferred daughter-in-law candidate, who was sulking in the corner with a plate of deviled eggs.
Oh, Janie.
She smiled indulgently at me, fluffing my hair.
You know I could never stay mad at you, even though you did hurt my feelings. You're my little angel muffin.
I'd forgotten about the nicknames. How could I have forgotten the nicknames?
Besides, I don't spend much time with Hannah Jo anymore because I didn't know.
Mama Ginger lowered her voice.
That she has a shoplifting problem. Every time we went to the flea market, she walked out with packages of socks under her jacket. Besides, do you know she's cut off her mama? Doesn't even talk to her anymore. Doesn't see her at Christmas or Mother's Day or send her birthday cards. Can you imagine someone having such a hard heart that they cut off their mama?
Wow. I cringed as realization dawned. So I guess that means you don't want her to marry Zeb anymore. Mama Ginger sighed.
No, I only wanted Hannah Jo to get to know Zeb because she's so lonely. And I thought since Zeb's such a good friend to you, he could be a good friend to her, too. My boy's so generous and sweet and kind. He'd have to be to take up with that one.
Mama Ginger shot a glare in Jolene's direction. Jolene's a very nice girl, I said. She's very good to Zeb. He loves her very much. I just said very 3 times, didn't I?
You're sweet to say nice things about someone who's taken what's rightfully yours.
Mama Ginger pinched my cheeks again.
But it don't matter how perky their ass is. No one's going to take your place in Zeb's heart. You're always going to be his first.
Ignoring the ass comment, I asked, his first?
Love, silly. You're his first love. No one forgets his first love.
I had a vague vertigo sensation as Mama Ginger's maternal crosshairs focused on me again. I'll see you later, Mama Ginger. I need to get back to... I gotta go.
We'll talk soon, baby doll,
she called, as I pivoted on my heel, made a grab for an empty iced tea pitcher, and focused on the main stage, the front pew. Grandma was resplendent in her traditional casual corner petite's black dress suit, but she had stepped up her game with a black picture hat and a full veil. Long ago, she had figured out a secret combination of waterproof mascara and eyeliner that gave her a full Elizabeth Taylor lash that never ran. A black lace handkerchief was clutched to her lips as she stifled a sob. Where do you even buy a black lace handkerchief? Widows R Us? If she was this duded up for the visitation, I deeply regretted that I wouldn't get to see her burial ensemble. As amusing as this was, the whole funeral process had put me in a bit of a philosophical funk. Despite Jenny's offer to give me a proper burial, there was very little chance that I would ever have a funeral. If by some chance, involving sunlight, stakes, or silver, I did die, the only remains left would be a little pile of dust. Unless someone was quick with the whisk broom, there would be nothing to put in a casket or urn. There would be no buffet, no packed chapel, and unless Reverend Neal was feeling very charitable, no one praying over me. It was far more likely that I would watch all of my friends and family die. I would watch Zeb grow old and die. I would watch his children grow old and die. Nothing would change. Nothing would surprise me. These dark, admittedly self-indulgent and depressing thoughts were not really putting me in the best frame of mind to deal with my grandma, who at the moment was sniffling into the black hanky and looking on old friends with baleful, glittering eyes.
"I'll be fine," she whimpered. "As long as I have friends and family around me, I'll be fine."
She looked up and saw me standing nearby.
"Jane, those coffee cups need washing."
These were the first words she'd spoken to me since she found out that I'd been turned, and they were completely consistent with our BD, before-death relationship. I thought back to the chapter in Sense and Sensibility when Mr. Dashwood has just died. Marianne and Mrs. Dashwood are overcome by grief. They gave themselves up wholly to their sorrow, seeking increase of wretchedness in every reflection that could afford it, and resolved against ever admitting consolation in the future. This leaves Eleanor to deal with their grasping relatives. Eleanor isn't given the chance to grieve because she's able to handle all of the grunt work. I was definitely an Eleanor, minus the quiet dignity, or the sense. But I was dependable, overly analytical, and unable to shirk excessive responsibilities. So I gathered the coffee cups and bit my tongue. "I'll just take them into the kitchen," I muttered, "and join the other scullery maids." I hefted the tray with one hand and nearly ran smack into my high school crush, Adam Morrow, a blonde, dimpled, and ridiculously clean-cut veterinarian.
"Adam!" I stuttered. "Hi!"
At least one thing had remained constant since my living days. I still couldn't find anything to say to Adam Morrow. While contemplating the back of his neck in sophomore English, I had daydreams where Adam suddenly realized how luminously beautiful I was, inside and out. He would finally realize that I was more than the brainy gal jocks wanted to be paired with on group projects. He'd ask me where I'd been all his life. There was also an imagined prom night scenario that I won't go into. And now, all I could do was gawk at him and keep a death grip on a tray of dirty coffee cups.
"Hi, Jane," he said, smiling broadly. "It's nice to see you again. It's been a while."
"What are you doing here?" I blurted. "Woo-hoo! A full, unstuttered sentence." Adam was carrying a carefully Tupperware'd 7-layer salad, though how anything involving hard-boiled eggs, bacon, mayonnaise, and sugar could be considered salad, I have no idea.
"Mama sent me over with this. She had dental surgery this afternoon, and she's laid up on the pain pills. She's sorry she couldn't make it."
"That was very thoughtful," I said, accepting the bowl with my free hand.
"And heavy. How much bacon is in this thing?"
"Just enough." He laughed, bottomless cerulean eyes twinkling.
"What about you? Are you doing something different with your hair?"
he asked, staring at me closely.
"Because you look different. Great, but different."
He was staring at me again as if I were a puzzle he was trying to solve. Apparently, word hadn't gotten around to Adam about my undead status. So for reasons I didn't quite fathom yet, I lied through my pointy teeth.
"I've been working out,"
I told him, smiling brightly. His interest seemed to perk up even further at the display of teeth.
"What have you been up to? How's the clinic?"
He shrugged those wide shoulders.
"Oh, you know. Patients who bite me and pee on themselves. It's a living. How about you?"
I grimaced. "Well, I'm sure you heard that I'm no longer working at the library." His cheerfully blank face gave me the impression that he was too polite to acknowledge that I was being gossiped about behind my back. I continued, "I'm actually working at a bookstore over on Braxton Avenue now. I really like my new boss. I've never really done retail before, but I get to work around books again, so it's great. I've sort of moved on to another phase of my life, a phase that does not include story time and sock puppets."
Adam chuckled, winking his dimples at me. "You should keep your options open. You never know what might come up."
"Like a bullet wound and an old guy willing to gnaw on my neck to save my life." That was a surprise. At the thought of Gabriel, I felt a little twinge of guilt. It felt very wrong to do anything even remotely resembling flirting. And even worse when Adam blurted, "It's been... I'd like to... Would you like to meet up for coffee sometime?" Well, there went a bigger twinge. I did a bit of a double take. Sure, I'd heard him wrong. "I'm sorry, could you repeat what you just said?"
"Coffee," he laughed. "Would you like to have a cup of coffee sometime? Catch up, talk about old times, share embarrassing memories, that sort of thing."
"You mean like when I used to follow you around at middle school dances, trying to work up the nerve to ask you to slow dance to End of the Road?" "Oh, crap, that was out loud. I have to stop doing that."
"Don't worry," Adam laughed. "It's kind of flattering."
I laughed, too, but more as a defense mechanism than out of actual amusement.
"So, coffee?"
Adam asked pointedly.
"Yes?"
There it was. Everything I'd wanted as a human laid out on a platter before me. If you'd asked me when I was a teenager, what would fulfill every romantic hope and dream in your obsessive adolescent heart, Adam Morrow asking me out would do it. As much as I'd tried to embrace my vampire lifestyle, it was difficult to let that go. It actually pained me when I had to say, "I appreciate the offer, but I'm seeing someone." Adam clearly wasn't used to being turned down. It took him just as long to process the fact that I'd said no as it did for me to realize that him asking me out wasn't an auditory hallucination. He finally said,
"Well, you can't blame a guy for trying. I'll see you around, Jane."
After watching a deflated Adam making his way through the funeral crowd, I busied myself gathering dirty plates and forks. I'd made it halfway to the kitchen when a sharp poke to my side made me squeal and fling cutlery. Panic and my vampire reflexes had me plucking the falling pieces out of the air.
"Fast hands,"
said my Uncle Junior, the one who finds sneaking up behind me and startling me the height of hilarity.
"That just gets funnier and funnier every time you do it,"
I retorted, poking through his paunch at his ribs.
"Aw, honey, he doesn't know any better,"
Uncle Paul said, shaking his head.
"Mama dropped him a lot when he was a baby."
Paul and Junior were Dad's brothers. I liked both of them, but when I was growing up, they were always so busy with their big, strapping sons, Dwight and Oscar. And they actually managed to move a whopping 45 minutes away from Half Moon Hollow, so I didn't see them except around holidays.
"How's my shortcake?"
Uncle Paul asked. "You're 7 feet tall. Everybody's shorter than you," I said, kissing his cheek and following our usual comedy routine. "Just wait until old age catches up with you. We'll see who laughs last."
"Your mama told us you'd had some health problems,"
said Uncle Junior, who hugged me hard enough to crack mortal ribs.
"I guess you could call it that,"
I said, suspicious thoughts beginning to churn in my brain.
"Those deer ticks are everywhere,"
Paul said, clucking and shaking his head.
"That's why I duct tape my pants legs around my socks when I go turkey hunting."
Had I accidentally walked into a French film? It was as if they were having a totally different conversation.
"Yeah?
There are treatments nowadays, aren't there?"
Junior asked.
"It's not supposed to affect your lifespan or anything, is it?"
"No, quite the opposite," I muttered.
"That's great, sweetie.
he said, chucking me under the chin. I'd hate to think of my niece keeling over from Lyme disease.
Lyme disease?
Lyme disease? I thought it bore repeating outside my head.
You just let us know if you need anything,
Uncle Junior said.
If those doctors don't treat you right, we'll kick their asses.
You know, most of our conversations end that way, I noted.
And we always mean it,
Uncle Paul assured me.
Now we're going to say hi to your grandma and then give your dad a hard time.
I turned and zeroed in on a woman simultaneously serving coffee and simpering. Mama. I'll see you all later. I stormed as quietly and subtly as possible across the room. Daddy saw that look on my face, caught my arm, and pulled me to a quiet corner.
Honey, whatever you're about to say to your mama, I'm sure she deserves it, but this is a funeral. Bob's family, at least, deserves our respect.
Daddy, as the only sane member of the family, I love you and respect your opinion. That's why I'm going to address the situation quietly and calmly in a nice private corner where I will not make a scene. The eerily calm tone got Daddy to release my arm before he heard me say, while I slowly choke the breath from her body. By the time he called, Jane, in a warning tone, I had already grabbed Mama from a gaggle of tutting church ladies and dragged her into an alcove.
Lyme disease, Mama? Really?
What? Mama asked, the picture of innocence.
You told the uncles I have Lyme disease.
I told them you had some health issues, she spluttered. They just assumed it was Lyme disease.
No one assumes you have Lyme disease, I whispered. How do you just assume Lyme disease?
I know this hasn't been easy for you, Mama. I know you're embarrassed that I'm different. I know it took you months to work up the nerve to be around me without being afraid or ashamed.
I'm not ashamed of you, Mama insisted. It's just that everyone makes these assumptions about me and your daddy. I know it's not true, but it's so difficult knowing that people are looking at me and judging and whispering.
But it's not even like this makes me the most scandalous member of the family. I'm bothered by the fact that Junie manages to pick up singles without using her hands while she performs at the booby hatch. But do I say anything? No.
It was at that moment that I realized that we were standing next to a podium. A podium with a mic on it. A mic that was on.
Crap. We turned to find most of the bereaved watching us, horrified. And my cousin Junie didn't look thrilled with me either.
Chapter 5.
Hostility toward human males marrying into were-clans is to be expected and taken seriously. Potential sons-in-law may want to carry wolfsbane or silver items in their pockets. Wares find both substances to be extremely irritating. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. Despite Bob's being laid to rest on a cloudy day, I elected not to go to his burial. I thought it might build strange expectations for Mama. Aunt Jetty, who relished her role as my go-to daytime spy, reported that Bob's burial was much more entertaining than his visitation. Grandma Ruthie had gone from grieving widow to seeing herself as some sort of postmodern, postmenopausal Juliet. She wore an even bigger veiled hat to the cemetery and a black crepe dress with a full, flowing skirt and trailing sleeves. I'm thinking she bought it from the Gone with the Wind widow's collection. She wailed and screeched her way through the eulogy, screamed, "Why, Lord, why?" through the final blessing, and tried to snatch Bob's service flag away from his son when it was presented by the honor guard. Also, she demanded front row center seats for her and her male companion, Wilbur. That's right. My grandma brought a date to her fiancé's burial. She's all class, that lady. Apparently, she'd met Wilbur at Whitlow's as he was heading into an old army buddy's visitation. Sparks flew, time stood still, and Grandma Ruthie snagged another victim. On the upside, I think Wilbur's presence may have been the only thing that kept her from flinging herself into the grave on top of the casket. But somehow, my outing cousin Junie as a day-shift dancer at the booby hatch made me an embarrassment to the family. At the burial, Grandma had declared that she wouldn't speak to me until I apologized to Junie.
I would think this odd, considering that Junie was a cousin on my dad's side of the family and Ruthie was my maternal grandmother. But Grandma Ruthie liked 99% of the general population better than me, so why not cousins on the other side of the family? During my shift that night, Aunt Jetty came into the shop to give me all the details of the cemetery theatrics. She was in the middle of reenacting this declaration when a little woman in a double-knit pantsuit came into the shop to claim a phone order. Aunt Jetty made herself scarce. On the phone, Esther Barnes' voice had sounded deep and accented. In person, she was squat, with dyed jet-black hair, deep wrinkles at the edges of her eyes, and a smoky topaz cocktail ring the size of a door knocker. Her voice was reedy and thin as she asked whether I had the Barnes order ready yet. I pulled her reserved copies of Mind Over Matter, Maintaining Your Psychic Ability, and The Search for the Inner Id from under the counter and rang them up. There was something off about Esther Barnes. Her eyes were too bright, too sharp. Her mouth was small, thin, pinched into a coral-painted bird-like moo. From the way her gaze was sweeping across the shop, I would guess she was calculating the value of every item in the store. "Are you new in town, Miss Barnes?" I asked, my tone light and friendly, even as I watched her weigh a brittle amethyst ceremonial blade with her even more fragile-looking hands.
"No."
She put the blade down, slapped her money on the counter, and stared at me. I would guess this stare had put many a shop girl in her place over the years, but, well, I was bored, and she was there. I smiled pleasantly. "Have family around here?" Her eyes narrowed as what little politeness she offered drained out of her voice.
"No."
I held up a newly printed specialty books brochure. "Would you like to be put on our mailing list?" Okay, at this point I was just trying to be annoying. Miss Barnes narrowed her eyes at me. There was a buzzing sensation, like being slapped under the forehead. Ow. It was as if someone let loose a hive full of bees in my head, little stings and pricks on the edge of my brain. I gripped the counter as the room spun out of focus. My head dipped as if I were just a bit tipsy, then snapped back into place as I fought for focus. Annoyed, I closed my eyes and built up a wall around my mind. I focused on the little woman in front of me and attempted to slap back, but it was like grabbing at sand. I couldn't get a grip. The edges of her consciousness kept slipping through my fingers. I did well just to maintain control of my own psychic defenses and not pass out at her feet. Exhausted by what was really just a moment's effort, I opened my eyes to find a smug smile stretched across Ms. Barnes' face.
"Better luck next time, dear."
Did I just get psychically pimp-slapped by a little old lady? After she sauntered out of the shop, I hustled back to the stacks and grabbed a copy of Mind Over Matter, Maintaining Your Psychic Ability. What the hell is in this book? I checked Mr. Wainwright's records for Ms. Barnes' contact information. And by records, I mean the stack of scrap paper he kept in the back of the cash register drawer with scribbled customer names and addresses. She was nowhere to be found, which was not a surprise. He did, however, have the address for a man who lived in Possum Trot and called himself Nostradamus, which made a certain amount of sense. I opened Mind Over Matter and scanned a few pages, trying to find the section on how to use one's mental talents to smack people around. Nothing. Esther Barnes was clearly playing a deck stacked with a few extra cards. How do you guard against someone who can reach into your skull and scramble stuff around? "I'm going to have to make a tinfoil hat," I muttered as the phone rang. It was just then that I realized how wrong I was to think that being brain assaulted was going to be the worst part of my day. It was my mother, calling to remind me that the annual Jameson family tree trimming party was coming up that weekend and that I needed to wear my Frosty the Snowman sweater for the family Christmas card picture. Mama always artfully arranged our candid family tree trimming picture 1 week after Thanksgiving, so she was able to send the Christmas cards out by December 14th, 1 week before her arch enemy and best friend, Carol Ann Riley. I don't think Jenny and Grandma would be very happy about seeing me.
"But y'all got along so well at the visitation,"
Mama cried. Being glad that someone will wash dishes and being happy that they were present are two different things.
Now you're just being silly, Jane. You're just going to have to learn to kiss and make up with Grandma and Jenny for the holidays. I won't stand for this. It was one thing for you to miss Thanksgiving, but this is getting ridiculous. Where else are you going to go?
Actually, I might have plans. I lied. Mama gasped.
What do you mean you have plans? It's not Christmas unless you're with family.
Well, I have some new friends this year, and they don't have family around here. I thought it would be nice to spend some time with them.
New vampire friends,
Mama said, just a hint of bitterness tinging her tone. No, not all of them are vampires.
Well, if you want to throw away years of tradition, that's your choice. If you really want to spend the first Christmas since we lost you with strangers, that's your decision to make.
What do you mean, lost me? I'm right here.
I can't keep talking about it, Jane.
Talking about what? We don't talk about this at all. Mama sighed, the slightest edge of a sniffle curling at the end.
Will you at least come to the tree-trimming party so we can take the family picture? Not everyone has to know that you and Jenny have had a falling out.
Can't you just Photoshop me in or something? I asked.
I don't even know what that means, Mama grunted. Just show up Saturday at 6.
I hung up the phone and commenced thumping my head against the leaded glass counter.
If you keep doing that, it's going to leave a mark. A smooth, bemused voice said, Even your healing powers have limits.
I looked up to find Andrea Byrne standing in front of me, smirking.
You look perturbed.
Well, more perturbed than usual, she said, examining the paling bruise on my forehead. What was your first clue? I asked grumpily. Andrea reminds one of what Grace Kelly might have looked like with red hair and a twisted backstory. Broke after her split with her fickle bastard, undead ex, and disowned by a firmly anti-vampire family, Andrea came to the Hollow years before to get a job in a boutique downtown. But her real income came from clients who enjoyed her blood in a mutually safe environment for a small fee. Andrea was the first and last human I fed from. It made for a rather awkward beginning to our friendship, but she was the one human I knew who truly understood the bizarre aspects of my new vampire lifestyle. She was sort of like my undead blankie, keeping me connected to the living world. Mama would have done the same thing, but with more guilt and sunburns. She hefted both mind over matter and the spectrum of vampirism off the counter and winced.
A little light reading?
Just researching my roots, I said, flipping spectrum to the chapter titled Global Origins. Like this charming theory, for example. Gypsies believed that vampires returned from the dead to seek vengeance on those who may have contributed to their death or neglected to give them a proper burial. Graves were watched carefully for signs of being disturbed. Exhumed corpses that were bloated or had turned black would be staked, beheaded, and burned. Well, why didn't they just blast the remains out of a cannon? Humans are stupid.
I'm standing right here, Andrea griped.
Oh, you're not really human. You're like one of us, only with a pulse.
And Mr. Wainwright?
Same goes, I nodded. You don't normally come in here. What's up?
I'm bored.
Bored? I asked. She nodded.
Ever since Dick became interested in me, all but my most loyal clients have stopped calling. I don't know if they're in doubt of my taste or frightened of Dick, but either way, it's not good for business.
Well, thanks for thinking of me, I grinned. I'm off in a couple of hours. What do you want to do?
Oh, I know. Why don't we go out for a nice girls' night, get into a bar fight, and then, just for kicks, one of us could end up suspected in a vampire murder. That would be fun,
Andrea suggested brightly.
Oh, wait. We did that already.
You think you're being funny, but you're not funny. When I tell the story, I don't tell people about you being knee-walking drunk, ergo unconscious during the whole fight. I think I'm going to change that policy.
You actually tell people that story?
I nodded. But when I tell it, Walter is 6'3" and a trained cage fighter. Andrea chuckled.
I grinned slyly. Dick has been looking for you.
She grumbled.
He doesn't know the meaning of the word restraining order, does he?
Technically, that's two words. I giggled. Dick and Andrea sitting in a tree. B-I-T-I-N-G. Ow! I whined as she punched my shoulder. You're just mad because secretly, underneath that sophisticated exterior, you're hot for Dickie.
I am not hot for Dickie,
Andrea spat. Me and my bruised shoulder say thou dost protest too much, I said dryly.
He's practically stalking me. He just won't let it go. He's being a jackass with a flaky jackass crust and a delicious jackass filling.
So he's jackass pie? I asked, making my ew face.
There's no reason to be crass, Andrea mewed primly.
You know, you're starting to talk like me. I find this more than a little troubling. Maybe we should spend less time together.
I could come up with jackass pie on my own, she insisted, then mulled over that statement. No. No, I couldn't.
By the way, what are your plans for Christmas? I asked.
Pretending my parents haven't disowned me, watching It's a Wonderful Life and drinking a few bottles of Merlot. How about you?
I chewed my lip. I'm thinking of throwing together a little party for us disenfranchised monsters.
You're using us as an excuse not to spend time with your family?
No, I'm choosing to spend time with my dearest friends, I retorted. Fine, it's 80% spending time with you guys and 20% avoiding my family. Andrea shot me her best doubtful glare. 70-30, I said as the doorbell tinkled. I was confronted with the sight of a weeping werewolf, clutching a bear trap in one hand and a wedding planner in the other. There's something you don't see every day. A curious Mr. Wainwright poked his head out of the office, illogically thrilled at the sight of a tearful werewolf in his shop.
"This is the most traffic the shop has had in years," he said, smiling brightly. "Jane, would your friends like a cup of tea?"
"Why don't you put the kettle on?" I suggested in a voice as calm and soothing as I could muster. "Andrea Byrne, Jolene McLean," I said, eyeing Jolene in the bear trap warily. "Jolene, honey, what's wrong?"
"Zeb,"
she wailed plaintively.
"What about Zeb? Is he okay?" I demanded, sniffing the trap, but finding no scent of blood.
"He's fine."
Her deeply backwoods accent stretched the word out into
"fine" before she wailed, "He's called off the wedding."
Visions of an unworn, unreturnable peach sateen bridesmaid's dress lurking in the back of my closet flashed before my eyes. I shuddered. "I thought we agreed that you guys weren't going to come to me anymore with your problems."
"But this time is different," Jolene wailed. "This time I need help."
"Okay, okay." I took the trap out of her hands and wrapped my arms around her. She sniffled into my shirt, leaving a spreading wet stain on my shoulder. "Are you sure that he called off the wedding, Jolene? Sometimes Zeb misspells stuff in emails and it comes across badly."
"Of course I'm sure."